This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, as usual, Brooke Spector. And today's guest is Anita Powell, a Washington-based reporter with significant experience in Africa, where we got to know her here in Johannesburg some years ago. There has been an enormous amount of amazing things happening in Washington over the last, since we last talked.
That's one way of putting it, Brooks.
We go to Anita every once in a while to get an update on the wonders and mysteries of Washington, and there are some serious wonders and mysteries taking place. For some light entertainment that has deep metaphorical and symbolic value, tell me a little bit about the reflecting pool. What is it and why does it have the troubles it has?
Okay. So the reflecting pool is a very long, beautiful pool in front of the Washington Monument. You have a clear shot of the reflection of the Washington Monument from where you stand at the Lincoln Memorial. It's a beautiful monument to, you know, American excellence, also democracy. And President Trump decided some weeks ago suddenly that he needed to renovate the pool and repaint the bottom of the pool a deep American blue. Problem is, we're in Washington, D.C. It's technically in the American South. It's about 3 million degrees outside right now. That's Celsius or Fahrenheit. It works. 3 million degrees and like 500% humidity. And when they were draining this pool for this $14 million repainting that was issued, this contract was issued without any notice. Nobody knew it was even coming. It's questionable whether the contract was legal, because government contracts, of course, have to go through a lot of processes to be on the up and up, to make sure that, you know, you're not just paying off your friends to do work for the government. I would never accuse anybody of that. But that is why the checks and balances exist, because people have that inclination. We're humans, you know. But anyway, so they repaint the thing, this dark American flag blue. Then they refill it. And they refill it, of course, with unfiltered water from the Potomac River. And going back to just the physics of the thing, it's 1 billion degrees outside in an insane humidity. And so in the pipes all this time has been growing this beautiful bright green algae. And when they fill up the pool, it fills with algae. So the blue pool turns green. Womp, womp. I don't know, Brooks. I mean, you mentioned it as a metaphor. And I think metaphor is a narrative choice. You could see this as, you know, man's quest to best nature and man's arrogance and wasted $14 million, blah, 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 blah. I mean, or you could also... you could also see that there are other bigger fish to fry in America right now. Or you could see this as, I don't know, in the words of America's children, you could see this as a womp womp moment, just bad luck. But they could have maybe foreseen this.
I thought of it was symbolic, actually. Those of us living in South Africa, many of us have swimming pools in our backyards. Mm-hmm. And we tend to treat our pool as if it is a real cost center and a sort of a child that hasn't quite learned good habits yet. And we are forever dealing with the mysteries of chemistry as relates to a swimming pool. And you would have thought that this was something, the technology of which was understood, mm-hmm. controllable, and manageable. And now here we are, what, 2 weeks before, less than 2 weeks before the 4th of July, and this thing is no longer going to be blue, and it's going to be green. You could argue it's a it's an experiment in environmental friendly behavior. It's the greening of America, if you will.
Oh, I love that. I love that interpretation. I mean, it's definitely symbolic, and a lot of Americans are making jokes about it, along with, I mean, all of the aesthetics of this Trump administration, like the removal of his name on the Kennedy Center that just happened recently. But this is distracting, I think, from, I mean, $14 million, as you and I know, having worked in the U.S. government, is diamond dust in the American budget. It's very easy to look at this big, long symbol of perhaps poor planning or whatever. You would think that somebody with extensive contracting experience would know just, the basics of biology and seasonal behavior of plants. But I think it's obvious that President Trump is not a gardener because in order to garden, you have to be able to bend over at the waist, and I've never seen him do that. So I guess he just doesn't know these basic facts of biology. But yeah, you could see this as a hubris as Trump's folly, but I think there might be other candidates for that term.
Yeah, no, I'm sure of that. I mean, part of the problem is that the reflecting pool, it's not real deep. It's less than a meter deep, really. It's big in extent,
It's the biggest. It's the biggest anyone's ever seen. Sorry,
but the
borrowing
real
some Trump
the re no
language
the
there.
re no 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 the real problem is that it has enormous symbolic value in American history. Yes, Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial facing this reflecting pool in 1962. But Marian Anderson, a renowned contralto singer, African American, once she was locked out of Constitution Hall, Eleanor Roosevelt organized it so that she could sing from, again, the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to a vast crowd, rallies for all manner of purposes, all manner of topics for the government, opposed to the government, have taken place at that Lincoln Memorial steps facing the reflecting pool. And this leads me to my next topic. And Anita, I know you are a martial arts person.
I was worried we were going to get to this. Yep, go on.
You know where I'm going with this.
Yes, I do.
I wonder, did you go down to the White House or the nearby viewing area to watch the United Fighting Championships on the White House grounds in the evening in that giant arena that was built
The
over
Claw.
the White?
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's called The Claw.
that one. That thing. Did you go or did you see any part of this? And what is the general population's reaction to this thing?
Well, so America's a deeply divided country. So there are, of course, many Americans who think that this is awesome. And it, of course, was a show of sportsmanship. No disrespect to those fighters. They work really hard. The disrespect to the fighters, by the way, I think came in the decision to put them in an arena that was outdoor at night in Washington, which is a humid environment. So there were just swarms of mosquitoes on all of these fighters. And then, as Joe Rogan, noted commentator and thought leader, said, it's a disservice to the sport to make fighters work in that condition. I mean, it verges on the gladiatorial. The gladiatorial metaphor was, of course, brought up a lot around this fight. The weigh-in was memorably at the Lincoln Memorial, which I think this is the first time in American history we've had a weigh-in at a monument. It was very strange. The whole thing, I think the word I might use is strange. It was overall very strange. But I think what's important to just note, if we're talking about the integrity of the sport and mixed martial arts, I don't think it was ideal conditions, and nobody in the sport thinks it was ideal conditions for these fighters. It was kind of exploitative the way that they were asked to work under these conditions. Their locker room was across the street in the old Eisenhower Executive Building. Getting to the venue would have been a little bit of a trek in that weather. It's not great for their preparation and their readiness to have to fight in those conditions.
Anita, I'm going to have to take a station break.
Sure.
We will be right back and we'll continue our conversation with Anita Powell, Washington-based reporter, a woman of vast experience in Africa, of course. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back after these messages. You're listening, of course, to Chai FM.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and this is your host, Brooke Spector, and you're listening to a conversation I'm having with Anita Powell, Washington-based reporter. And we were talking about the United Fighting Championship engagement in front of the White on the south side of the White House, actually. I read polling data that said only 16% of the population of the country thought this was an appropriate thing to do on the White House grounds. That seems to be saying that it was fairly unpopular, or that it was seen as disrespectful to the national spirit and the institution and the building itself. But let me switch slightly to our conversation to what's just happened in another venue, that is the G7 meeting in France, which I think is actually rather more important than the mixed martial arts competition and and the G7 meeting and its relationship to the much heralded but less than content heavy agreement in the memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran. Where are we in this? This has perplexed and confused millions, I think.
Okay, so let's separate that out. I think we want to talk about Iran first. And it's dangerous to talk about Iran at any given moment on any radio podcast or any news platform, because as we know by now, President Trump changes his mind. You know, we know that he's signed this document that lays out some broad agreements. It's a 60-day window to make a decision on the nuclear issue. But more importantly, it's a 60-day reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, laying the foundation for the Iranian regime to one day, impose tolls on all traffic through that strait. So that's something new. And it also includes all cessation of hostilities, including in Lebanon. And this was key. But this means that now the Trump administration has to keep an eye on Israel to make sure they don't start that up again. So this is a complicated agreement, but it's undergirded by the things that Trump says in public, like, if I don't like it, I'm going to drop bombs on their heads. I mean, it's a very interesting diplomatic choice that he's making. The good news, I think, for people in your listening area is that this will, if the strait remains open for 60 days, if things quiet down a little, if traffic resumes, we should see a resumption of traffic in fertilizer and fuel. This is, of course, very important for the developing world. The global south has been disproportionately impacted by this. We were expecting, I think, the South African economy to be worse affected than it was. But as you know, the Q1 growth was a little bit better than expected. But we might see that those effects later on, because there's always a delay in things like this. So, I mean, for people on the ground who are trying to buy petrol, who are trying to, you know, grow crops, this is still a problem. This is still a lingering problem. And I just want to stress that because, I think the administration and the Iranian regime are kind of painting this as fait accompli and a victory. And yet for the billions of people who are caught in the middle of this resource-based conflict, it's not a clean victory. In terms of the agreement, I have to love the I will agree with you that it was a metaphor that he signed it at Versailles. And this plays into my theory that Trump is not much of a reader, because treaties and agreements signed at Versailles don't always go very well. You know what I'm talking about. You want to give everyone the explanation.
The formal ending of hostilities in World War I was signed in the Palace of Versailles. The Germans capitulated, obviously, and were given an enormous burden of reparations to pay. And most historians agree that it set the stage for the collapse of German democracy and then the rise of Adolf Hitler, World War II, and everything that that included, which none of which is particularly salutary. But at Versailles also was the site where the French capitulated to the Prussians in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71, humiliating the French. Versailles was, of course, built
the
by
symbol. It's the
Louis
symbol
XIV.
Of decadence and let them eat cake. And it's the, it's a choice. And I don't know how you avoid the metaphor looking at that choice to sign in at Versailles. But I don't think that Trump knows that necessarily, because I said he's not much of a reader. But before he went to Versailles, he was very excited to be invited to dinner at Versailles with President Macron. And I love how he said, Versailles is not gold leaf, it's the real deal. And I wanted to be like,
Did they let him eat cake?
Oh, I was about, yeah, okay. I knew that was
Sorry,
going to come up. Yeah, the Marie Antoinette reference. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's Versailles was the under the court of Louis XIV, it was the embodiment of excess and privilege and tone deafness. And that's putting it mildly, that's putting it in modern terms, right? I mean, people were starving in the French cities and countryside, and being abused by this nobility. But yeah, he ate lobster and caviar, just so you know, I saw the menu. It was lobster and caviar. Although I can't say for sure whether Trump partook, because we know he's a man of simple tastes.
Yes. Well, there's a McDonald's in Paris. I know that. Not to put too fine a point on it. The memorandum of understanding, part of the challenge for people is interpreting the numbers that have been bandied about. The $300 billion reconstruction or renovation fund and the $1.7 billion unfrozen or to be unfrozen Iranian assets in the U.S., money held in escrow. And at the same time, there are lots of disparaging comments comparing it to
JCPOA.
the older
The
JCPOA,
JCPOA. Yeah.
the Five Nation plus the EU plus Iran, obviously.
So I don't think this is apples and oranges. I don't think you can really compare the MOU, which is of course not legally binding, whereas the JCPOA was. It had strict conditions, it had enforcement, it had a mechanism for observing and monitoring the Iranian nuclear program. This doesn't have any of that. It does have that $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran, which many analysts are taking as a pretty blunt sign, because this follows the Trumpian logic that Iran won the war. Because why are you giving somebody money? Why are you giving the loser money, right? Like, that's the logic. And that's pretty clean logic, because that is what President Trump has trained us to think, you know, that losers lose money, winners get money. So, I mean, he's a victim of his own logic here. I just want to note that 300 billion doesn't really exist right now.
No, it's notional. It's a figure
And
that's just out there.
it's super conditional. I mean, it's conditional on, and we've seen the president say this over and over again, like, if I don't like anything they're doing, I'm going to drop bombs on their head. And I just want to back up on that statement. That is a shocking statement from a head of state, especially after bombs were dropped on a girls' school, killing about 170 little girls. That is, I mean, you can't read that as anything but a conscious choice to bring up that trauma for those poor families, to say we're going to drop bombs on their heads. I mean, how. It's very striking language from a head of state, and one might say that it's definitely not diplomatic, but it's intended to strike fear into people's hearts. And I just, yeah, a lot
Thank you.
of yeah.
The kindest thing you could say about it was that it was wildly inappropriate.
Sure. Yeah.
What it does do, what this whole thing does do for me, and I'm going to betray my interest in arcane literature of the 1960s, obscure literature to be sure. Leonard Wilberly's book, The Mouse That Roared, which
Mouse
became a
that roared.
film on Peter Sellers played five or six different parts in this film. And it's a small mythic country in Europe that is going bankrupt, and they decide that the appropriate thing to do is to declare war on the United States, lose the war, get foreign assistance, and in the process steal the enormously powerful quaddium bomb and its developer, a scientist who just happened to have been born in the little tiny country of Grand Fenwick. This is begin. I'm going to have to look back at that book again, or maybe the because that is we're following a little too closely some of the plot lines in this story.
That's a fascinating observation, because, you know, this ties into something that Trump says all the time about immigration, where he says, you know, people are sending their criminals and whatever. And I always want to be like, sir, isn't that the plot of Scarface? Like, are you mistaking immigration in the United States with the plot of Scarface? Because that is the premise of Scarface, right? That dudes come out of prison in, why am I forgetting the country? Where does Scarface come from? Maybe your younger listeners will remember. He's not Cuban, he's like Colombian, maybe. Anyway. But yeah, Scarface, the drug dealer, the one who gave us all of those great lines, like, don't get high on your own supply. I mean, it's a great movie. Say hello to my little friend. And you
Yes.
can, and it just occurs to me that a lot of so maybe you're right, because as we know, Donald Trump is not a reader, but he does watch a lot of TV, and we are seeing a lot of ripped from movie interpretations instead of ripped from the headlines or maybe some textbooks or white papers. He's ripping things from the movies and imposing them on diplomacy. He's metaphorizing. And as I said, I mean, metaphor is a narrative choice, not a serious interpretation of reality. We've got to be really careful about that.
Let me switch topics for you because most people are vaguely aware of the fact the United States is once again on a Sisyphean task, a terrible treadmill of midterm elections. There have been primaries across the country. Some candidates endorsed by Donald Trump have been successful, and others have gone down in flames. And the choices that voters are making, admittedly a small number of voters, because primary elections in an off-year election don't usually get vast hordes of voters showing up. This sets up the possibility that in the actual general election in November the 3rd, that we're going to see the change in the party control of at least one house in Congress. Is that an accurate reading now, or am
Nope.
I over
You
overguessing it?
are like so many, you are a million months out from these polls. And as we say in Washington, polls are soft until October. I'm just looking at the polls right now, the generic congressional polls that show Democrats having an edge and show Trump's unfavorables at like 56%. But you know how elections work in the United States. We see an upping of the tempo, an October surprise. A lot could happen between now and the midterms. So I don't think that we should take this as anything. It isn't over until it's over. Nevertheless, I do, you know, the midterm results that are starting to roll in, and I'm talking about the primary results. We have now Americans in many states voting for their favorite candidate in their respective party. And as you mentioned, we've had some Trump candidate failures and some Trump candidate successes. Notably, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who's the stalwart in the Senate. I think he's served since at least Reconstruction, maybe the beginning of the Civil War. Who knows? That's a joke.
I think it was a couple of years after that, but never mind. He's been there for quite a long time.
He's a
And you know,
fixture.
hold this thought because we're going to take a quick station identification. And as we used to say in radio, long before anybody remembers, I guess at this point, don't touch that dial because now everybody uses electronic little switches. But don't touch that dial. We'll be right back with our conversation with Anita Powell, Washington-based reporter, woman with long experience in Africa, and just by the way, a martial arts specialist. She's now living in the U.S. And this is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and this is High FM, of course, and we'll be back right after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest, of course, Anita Powell, and we're continuing our conversation. And I interrupted her just as she was going to talk about Lindsey Graham, senator from what, South Carolina.
South Carolina. Yeah. Let me not be remiss though to take the opportunity to give a shout out to my coach George Cosi at Hillbrow Boxing Club, one of the finer gyms in the city. I just wanted to put that out there. You know, you always acknowledge where you came from. It's Ubuntu, right? If it weren't for George, I would not be the fighter that I am. And I don't know what that says about George because I'm not a great fighter, but he did his best with me. Anyway, going back to Lindsey Graham, another fighter who just cannot get knocked out. Here's the thing about the American electorate that is really fascinating. We don't have the same notion of like cadre discipline or party loyalty in the United States, not just because all of our elections are not partisan. You know, city council elections are usually not partisan. Of course, they're different in every state and every municipality, but they're usually not partisan. And so you have this situation where, I mean, Kentucky is a great example, where you have voters who on the same ballot will vote for a Democratic governor and then for the most right-wing Republican representative. And, you know, because people don't vote on party lines, and they see different, they want different things out of different roles. They're able to kind of say, maybe, you know, the classic example I would give is I'm from the state of Texas, and the only sheriff candidate to watch was the Republican one, because there was no way a Democrat was ever going to win a sheriff's election in Texas. They're seen as
That's
too
a local
soft.
election.
Right. That's a local election. But so if you wanted to vote for a meaningful candidate, you would have to vote for the Republican, because the Democrat didn't have a chance at winning that, because, you know, the Republicans call themselves the law and order party. You know, they have a reputation for being much more tied to law enforcement, and they have historical support there. So you could conceive of a lot of situations where, you know, the average American might vote for a Democrat for one office and a Republican for another and an independent for another. That's not, I know that seems a bit like, I feel like that seems a bit weird to South Africans to pick and choose, but we are the consummate buffet eaters in this country. And we like to pick and choose from the buffet of choices.
Yeah, that's hedging one's bets because there are different issues to be resolved at different
Yeah.
levels of government.
Right. So, I mean, this kind of weird fall, I mean, these results that we're seeing, they seem like a mixed bag, because they are, because voters are a mixed bag. But there are some interesting indications that we've seen already in the primaries. In my home state of Texas, we've seen a surprising show by the Democrat who's running for Senate. This is one of two offices. Every state has two senators. So it's a big deal. And he's up against former Attorney General of Texas, who is a man who's been impeached by his own party, a man whose wife divorced him on, quote, biblical grounds, which I don't even know what that means, but that's open
We
to some.
can imagine.
It's, I mean, it's one of those things. Yeah, it opens up the door to some fascinating interpretation. She declined to endorse her husband, which of course also speaks volumes.
But you should explain who the Democratic candidate is,
Sure. So
who is a fascinating fellow.
James Tallarico is, I believe he's like in his 30s. He's a seminarian. You know, I don't know much about his actual legislative or government history. I don't know where he served. I think he's in the State House right now. But
Yeah,
he,
he was a state legislator.
yeah, but he's a pretty clean Democrat, and on the social justice issues, he's really pushing a lot of Republican buttons right now, because he said, for example, that he does not believe that God has a gender. And this is, you know, fodder for endless attack ads against him. It's actually particularly gross. Stephen Miller, Trump's, what do we want to call Stephen Miller? The consigliere, the viceroy, the what do we want to call him? The Iago?
His official title is Deputy Chief of Staff, but consigliere
Iago.
is probably closer to the truth.
He has started this weird campaign where he's calling Tallarico the first trans candidate out of Texas, saying that he's transgender, which, of course, James Tallarico, as far as anybody knows, and it's, you know, he's the one who we should trust on this one, says, no, I'm not transgender. I was assigned male. I'm living male, whatever. So
And
it's getting.
he has a fiance, or he's about ready to get married. So,
Sure,
she is de
sure.
she's definitely female. So there you go.
Well, I mean, this is just weird. It's just a weird thing to attack somebody for, right? Like, there is one transgender representative in Congress. She only joined in the last election. That's how recent it's been that we've allowed, you know, major transgender representation in Congress. And even if, you know, you have strong feelings about gender, the nature of a democracy is that everybody has to be represented. And if you have like 1% or 3% representation of transgender people in your population, I bring up 3% because that's the world's highest rate of transgender population. It's in Germany, but I think in the United States it's about 1%. Then these are Americans who deserve to be to have their concerns represented in Congress, right? I mean, it's pretty straightforward. So it's a weird tack to take. So yeah, Tallarico versus Paxton. What's interesting is that Trump endorsed Paxton, the attorney general, over John Cornyn, who's the longtime senator. And so he knocked out John Cornyn for the perceived sin of being bipartisan, crossing the aisle to work with Democrats on certain things.
That's a heinous thought, that bipartisan.
Well, it's interesting because, I've followed Cornyn for a long time. I mean, I don't want to age myself, but I was at one of Cornyn's first rallies in the State House in Austin. It was in 2003, and his followers were yelling, "We want Cornyn, we want Cornyn," which I thought was not a that's not a slogan with wings. It just sounds weird. But anyway,
And
you know.
David, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Again, the gods at the Casa must be obeyed, and the sponsors are going to be insistent as well. So we will take this break. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, we're having a little fun with Anita Powell, longtime Washington reporter, but longtime South African-based reporter as well. And we'll be back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and this is your host, Brooke Spector, and you're listening to a conversation I'm having with Anita Powell, Washington-based reporter. Subliminal messages there, especially given the new prime minister in Japan, Sane Takaichi, or Takaichi Sane, her rather conservative and almost militaristic. I think that's a little bit overdrawn, but certainly when you talk about stability in borders, she's also talking about Taiwan without saying it.
Well, I mean, that's what I was saying. It's a dig at China. And it's over the Taiwan issue. I mean, you nailed it. And I knew you would have something fascinating to say on this, Brooks, because of course you spent lots of time in Japan as a diplomat. So I thought that was a really interesting outcome. The other ones I kind of expected, strong words calling for the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, this is consistent. And also, I thought it was interesting that the G7 has stepped up in providing defensive equipment for Ukraine, including air cover, which was, of course, the big debate at the beginning of the conflict with the Biden administration, because, of course, giving air defense or providing anything in the air could mean that you have NATO countries going into Ukrainian airspace, which is risking some sort of confrontation, which is risking the provocation of an Article 5 situation, which is the article in the NATO charter that says that if one is attacked, everyone comes to their aid. So it is interesting that Europe seems to be stepping up. This is what the president, President Trump, has been asking Europe to do all along. And I remember when I went to Germany with President Biden at the very end of this term, I asked his administration very clearly. I said, "Well, are you using this trip to Trump-proof NATO just in case he wins the election?" And of course, the National Security Advisor said, "I dispute your characterization, Anita, blah, 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 blah." But that is what has, in effect, happened. The mechanisms of control over NATO planning in Ukraine have largely fallen to the Europeans. And this is consistent, as I said, with what Trump has asked of Europe. He said, "Ukraine is in your backyard, not mine." Because Trump is not maybe a big picture dude about when it comes to things like the march of autocracy or, bigger world trends having an effect on all of us. He doesn't seem to think that's a big issue. Those were some of the outcomes of this summit. I thought it was very interesting. Trump met again with Zelensky. There was no clothing shaming at that meeting, as far as I know. But I mean, these summits are this one's going to cast forward now to the NATO summit, which happens later in the summer, and also the G20, which is going to happen later in the year.
I was going to refer to that and direct your attention to the G20 because it's going to take place in Florida, adjacent to or on Donald Trump's club. And South Africa apparently has been written out of that particular equation, much to their chagrin.
I don't know why South Africa is surprised, though. I mean, I think and it has not as much to do with Donald Trump as with South Africa's principal decision to pursue action at the ICC over U.S. and Israeli actions in the Palestinian territories after October 7th. I mean, that case, I asked the White House about it at the time, and they said it was without merit and completely free of content. I mean, they immediately dismissed it. But I think that South Africa being sidelined is something that maybe Pretoria should have expected when they took the United States on such moral grounds. I am not saying that I'm not saying who was right or who was wrong here, but I am saying that this is something that is not entirely surprising that South Africa is being sidelined.
I've always argued that each country is entitled under international law to have its own sovereignty and to make its own choices on foreign policy decisions, but decisions have consequences. Mm-hmm. And whatever decision you take, you need to be forward thinking about what those consequences might well be and your response to the consequences. You have to, it's a little bit like chess. You can't simply just assume that you do X and everybody goes, okay, that's fine.
Right. And this was a very sensitive spot for the Americans and the Israelis, of course. And of course, we haven't even talked about the Lady R incident, which I haven't even begun to unpack in my own mind. But that was another straw on the back of the U.S.-South Africa relationship. Another one, of course, has been put there by Donald Trump and his decision to expand the refugee program to only include Afrikaners, which, of course, is, as your audience knows very well, is kind of against the aims and goals of you know, Afrikaner campaigners who don't want to be refugees in a foreign land. They want to live in South Africa, their home. So it's interesting how tense things are getting between Pretoria and Washington, and frankly, a little bit worrying because, you know, as somebody who's lived in South Africa for a long time, Ubuntu is real. We need each other. We need each other in the small scale and in the large scale. And I don't know what the world looks like when, you know, the world superpower doesn't have a relationship with the country that, you know, can speak from experience about making a huge moral shift that included a huge, you know, shift in governance, a huge shift in administration. I'm talking about the end of apartheid, of course, and a country that serves as the financial and resource gateway to the rest of the continent. So this puts both countries, I think, in a very awkward position, although I think South Africa might have a little bit more latitude because there are other people they can go to other than the United States. So in a way, I think it's on the United States to kind of rescue this relationship. I don't know what tools we have left. I mean, I haven't, AGOA seems like a non-issue now in that there's so many other complicating factors in the relationship that restoring or boosting AGOA, I'm not sure what effect it would have.
Well, one of the things I've often said in conversations like this on other media or with other interlocutors is that fortunately, the relationship between the two countries, South Africa and the United States, is not simply the sum of official government-to-government relations. Because unlike many countries, there are, you know, take out a lot of fingers, count them, 600 or so U.S. companies involved in South Africa, and a number of serious South African companies involved in the United States. There are many people who travel here to South Africa from the U.S. and vice versa, either as tourists or business people or religious figures or
and this whatever. All makes it so super awkward that both ambassadors on both sides have been demarched or expelled. I mean, this is an impediment to those people-to-people relations and business relations that are so important, that are building blocks of solid relationships. You're right.
I mean, the what I'm getting at, of course, is that there's a good foundation to work from, even if at the top there's, you know, there's laser sword fighting going on over some fairly, in some ways, inconsequential questions. And yes, of course, there are things that do have serious substance as well, but there's lots that goes on regardless of the difficulties that the two governments and you know, the nasty grams that fly back and forth. I get the feeling, and this is just me, maybe, that the appointment of Ralph Mayer as South Africa's ambassador to the United States was something of an effort by the South Africans to say, okay, it's time to bring in some of the older adults and let them do what they can to begin to heal the rift. And I mean, Mayer has many things going for him, not the least of which is a long relationship with the current South African president. He is an Afrikaner by ethnicity. He served in the government in pre-94. So he has ways to talk to the Trump administration that his predecessor did not. And I
I
think
feel
maybe
like
that.
you're dancing around the fact that every South African is thinking right now, which is he's a white dude.
Well, he is that too,
I mean, like just I mean, I think a lot of your audience is like, yes, and he's a white dude. And for whatever reason, that does seem to land well with President Trump.
Well, I mean, you know, you give Cyril Ramaphosa a couple of, you know, a couple of gold stars for having thought through that appointment. There were
Well,
lots
you
of
saw
people.
who he took to his Oval Office confrontation. He took,
Yeah.
other prominent Afrikaners. This was a strategy. And, that I don't want to say for I don't want anyone to think that in including all of those people, that wasn't a concession, that wasn't a favor that Ramaphosa was doing. These are South Africans. I mean, it's the Rainbow Nation. He was showing the Rainbow Nation in all its glory, in all its multicultural, multilingual, multi-faith glory. And that's the best selling point of South Africa, other than, the gorgeous weather and the fantastic people. And it is because South Africans have had to learn to live together, and it's been a difficult path.
Anita, I'm sorry, but we're running out of time, and I have to draw this to a close. But we've been speaking with Anita Powell, a veteran reporter based in Washington now, but having spent considerable time in South Africa. We've covered most of the landscape here of topics. There's still a few things we could talk about, but we'll do that again sometime. Best to your family, who I hope are doing well. And this is the Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week with another conversation with another interesting guest on another topic. And as listeners know, we range on our topics from contemporary theater to nuclear physics to we did a program even on tariffs for dummies so that everybody could understand what in the heck a tariff was and why it mattered. But that's our job, and that's what we try to do, and we hope that people enjoy it. Anita, again, thanks very much. You're in Colorado. It's lovely. Say hi to your hosts, and we'll talk again soon.
Always a pleasure, and I thank your audience for putting up with us as we riff on all of these topics, and I hope they come away with it just with hope, because there is hope, and it resides in us, in ordinary people.
Indeed, you said it better than I would have said it. We're going to say goodbye, and to our listeners, please have a good, safe weekend. We'll be back again next Friday morning at 9 o'clock.